Blog Talk Radio.
August 31st, 2014 version of Masonic Free, Radio Freemason. My goodness, we've upgraded. This is an exceptional day. It's the Labor Day weekend here in Canada. It's Labor Day. For workers, the holiday held on in some places of the world on May Day, International Workers' Day. In Canada, it's celebrated in the first Monday of September. It's considered the official end of the summer holiday for most families. You got kids, children, if those with children are hanging around or getting them ready to be off for their, finish their education. And it was started here it's been going on here since the 1880s. And the origins here can be traced back to December 1872. And that was when there was a parade staged to support the Toronto Topographical Union strike for a 58-hour work week. The Toronto Trades Assembly called its 27 unions together to demonstrate in support of the Topographical Union, which had a strike on the 25th of March. George Brown, we know him with Toronto Globe, he's a Canadian politician and an editor, hit back at his employees. And he pressed the police to charge the Typographical Union with conspiracy. Although the laws criminalizing union activity were outdated and had already been abolished in Great Britain, they were sadly still on the books here in Canada, and police arrested 24 leaders of the union. Labor leaders decided to call another similar demonstration on the 3rd of September to protest the arrests. Seven unions marched in Ottawa, and that prompted a compromise by the Canadian Prime Minister, John A. Macdonald, to repeal, as he said, the barbarous anti-union laws. And that's when, on the 14th of June, Parliament passed the Trade Union Act, and soon all unions were seeking a 54-hour work week. Interesting, eh? They hadn't quite figured out that when people are working and slaving at factories, they didn't have time to spend. And without people being able to sell your product, you weren't really going anywhere. So the Toronto Trades and Union Council held similar celebrations every spring. An American by the name of Peter J. McGuire co-founded the American Federation of Labor, and he was asked to speak at a labor festival in Toronto on the 22nd of July in 1882, believe it or not. And when he went back to the United States, McGuire and the Knights of Labor organized a similar parade based on the Canadian event. And they held that on the 5th of September, 1882 in New York City. So you see a little bit of an influence. Before all the posturing and bravado and silliness took over, returning to the United States, McGuire and they went on to have that parade. And then it was on the 23rd of July in 1894 that the Prime Minister then was John Thompson, of course, everybody would know that, and his government made Labor Day an official holiday to be held in September. That's it. In the United States, the New York Parade became an annual event that year, and in 1894 was adopted by American President Grover Cleveland to compete with the International Workers' Day and May Day. You know, that's just far too unsavory for us here in North America. But it isn't, eh? Labor Day tradition in Atlantic Canada is the Wharf Rat Rally in Digby, Nova Scotia. While the rest of Canada watches the Labor Day Classic, you know, football games, and like the one between, these are what our British friends would call the Derbies, Calgary Stampeders and Edmonton Eskimos and Hamilton Ticats and Toronto Argonauts, except in 2011 and 2013 when we couldn't figure out the schedules. What a country. What a country. I love that. Just let history and tradition just blow out the window because, our bureaucrats couldn't quite get it. Don't you love this country? So Ontario University Athletics, they had a long-standing tradition to play university football on Labor Day. So Labor Day parades in Grand Falls, Windsor, Newfoundland started in 1921. That was well before it was part of Canada, of course, and it still continues to this day 90 years later. The celebrations go on for 3 days with a parade on Labor Day Monday. Man, you gotta love it. So a safe and enjoyable Labor Day holiday for you and yours. I hope it goes exceptionally well. Probably will. Today we have some interesting, we'll tip into some interesting Masonic fact, as we always do, and we'll start it off with a little bit of music. And today the themes, of course, are from east to west. We're going to start with a little bit of music from the east coast of Canada, just to recognize the tip of the hat to the entire country. I think you'll find this. Kind of interesting. Well, you may recognize this one. Eastern Canada, of course, Prince Edward Island's own.
Ever calls in Canada, we get to see them all. Creek. C-A-N-A-D-A, that had never seen a mountain peak. C-A-N-A-D-A, in the land of the fake snowball. In Canada, we get to see them all. We get to see the maple trees, maple sugar and the maple leaves. We got the biggest wheat fields growing tall. In C-A-N-A-D-A, where we see the reversing fall. In Canada, we get to see them all.
Of course, the icon from of Canada, Tom Connors, Stompin' Tom Connors. Interesting fella, truly. Hardworking, humble man all his life. Very much a committed Canadian. This is a fellow that refused awards because he felt that American business interests were interfering too much in Canadian decisions. Simple fellow from Eastern Canada, widely mocked, I guess, because of, he's mocked because of his rustic style of music. But when you're thinking about it, a Sudbury Saturday Night and the hockey song, and he was singing to the country folks that made Canada what it is today. And so on Labor Day, you have a hardworking Canadian reminding us. This is Tribute Day. I wanted to talk with you and get your advice, of course, about the study of merit and the nature of Freemasonic philosophy. The idea of merit seems to be, I think we have some difficulty with that. When it comes to the accumulation of knowledge, most nations, including our own, to this day, try to keep others out. We do. We want to amass the knowledge and keep it here, but we don't want anybody else really getting into it. You know, if we have ideas, we may find that, of course, the expectation is today that we're going to sell those ideas. And unless you're making money with your ideas, there's something wrong with them. This is a temporary little glitch in the history of mankind. But nevertheless, it's a predominant thought today. Is the only source of merit profit? That doesn't really say too much about us, if that's our thinking, as moral creatures. But there are exceptions to that notion of accumulation of knowledge. Today we will look at the effects of medieval Islamic scholarship in map making, optics, medicine, found in 12th to the 17th century, references and texts to Islamic thinkers. Just when Freemasons were convinced it was about personal advancement, Freemasonry comes along with an obvious statement that within the scope of ideas, merit is the basis of promotion. As we examine this, we find a journey into the history of Islam where the facts show threads of the mystery school we call Freemasonry. In 832 AD, just 70 years after the city of Baghdad was founded, the Caliph al-Ma'mun created the House of Wisdom after the museum in Alexandria was founded about 280 BC by Ptolemy I, Soter, known for advanced scientific and literary scholarship. So the House of Wisdom included Persian and Christian scholars drawn by the translation movement of ideas and culture to transcribe knowledge into a common language, that being Arabic, because the Caliph spoke Arabic. But historians run out of superlatives to describe it, and quote, unrivaled center for the study of humanities and science in medieval Islam included mathematics, astronomy, medicine, alchemy, and chemistry, zoology, geography, and cartography. Restrictions on the source of knowledge should not exist, but they do. Students of the craft often are schooled in, quote, Masonic texts. But doesn't it make sense that advancement based on merit has continued the House of Wisdom, exposing all initiates to scholarship? Why is it not democratic, you ask? Because intellect and ability are God-given tools, not for man to question. Advancement is always about the mind and indifferent to rank and privilege. When you think about merit, I think this is an interesting illustration. It's not who came first, it's the idea. So when we're talking about who came first, what we're doing is we're being political. We are being political. Our thinking is being political. It doesn't really matter. The fact that the idea exists. So we have everything from the decimal to zero to the concept of our algebra. These are things that were studied and were known to have been part of what was happening in a very great long time ago. And you think we're talking about somewhere at 250 AD to 832 AD. This is back in a very, very early time. And you can see these weren't necessarily the very first, but these were men who recognized they had the ability and the position to create an atmosphere of learning. Now, if we were to think that this was this is the world as we know it, well, not so. We'd have to take into account what was going on in China at the time. Now, these ideas you can think about how brilliant it was to bring all the greatest thinkers and writers together. And then to the translation movement was an actual effort to take all of that, just like we would, and put it into a common language. The language we would use is English. Does that make it better? Come on. We have a little more poise and confidence than that. But we would have to be able to say, we need a common language so our workers, our scientists, can speak with each other and develop those ideas. It's simple and makes sense. Better systems. Well, the Greeks picked up on this knowledge and they used it. The scholars around the world that idea that they were keeping knowledge out and restricting it, that really was what was under assault with this thinking. Wherever the knowledge is, we'll invite the best and brightest to come and speak with us and teach us. That gets the awkwardness is when somebody or some country or some culture believes that knowledge needs to be theirs. And that's where things begin to fall apart. There is no control over ideas. Never was. It's like the idea of freedom. As we found in the disgrace of the 20th century and the use of nuclear weapons to kill a massive number of people. No amount of justification, intellectualizing can ever overcome the fact that a member of the human race became death. And we have learned how to kill a lot of people. Let's not be too maudlin. We're talking about advancing ourselves, climbing out of the dust, and beginning to realize that diplomacy and discussion is what ends the wars. Or too often, our good friend who was there protecting the interests of the free world, what we know as the free world in the Second World War, he would often say. His understanding of the First World War is very stark because it was personal. He had relatives involved in it, and the Crimean. So it's nasty, the Boer War. There's a nastiness to all of that that needs to be overcome by merit. More thoughtful men saying that kind of thinking is simply wrong. The scaremongering, which happens whenever paramilitary and military organizations want to increase their budget, they always plant the seeds of fear in the minds of the simple. And does it work? Well, look at the size of these budgets. If we were part of a culture that was advancing human understanding, you would probably see the big budgets being placed in research and in education, wouldn't we? Hope springs eternal, and I think walking that path is being walked by and led by Freemasonry. Yeah, very small, very unassuming. Small, maybe small in number, but the ideas are huge and very welcome. Now, as we move across across this program today, I'm dealing with the work of Pliny the Elder. Always interesting. Of course, you know Pliny the Elder. You would know him as, you might know, he was the uncle of Pliny the Younger. I know. It's amazing how that works out, isn't it? Pliny the Elder helped raise Pliny the Younger. Pliny the Younger was a lawyer and author and magistrate in ancient Rome. And both Pliny the Elder and Younger witnessed the eruption of Vesuvius on the 24th of August in AD 79. And during that eruption, Pliny the Elder died. Now, Pliny wrote hundreds of letters, and a lot of that survives today. So it's part of the reason we know so much about this this fellow. He served as the imperial magistrate under Trajan. Trajan reigned between 98 and 117. And his letters to Trajan provide some of the most limited scraps of the relationship between the imperial office and provincial governors of Rome. Pliny, he was considered an honest and moderate man, and he was a friend of the historian Tacitus, and he even, it's neat, history proves these people to be quite bright, but he hired he had a guy named Suetonius working for him on his staff, and Suetonius became a biographer. But Pliny also came into contact with a lot of well-known people before. Artemidorus and Euphrates, those philosophers, he met them when he was over in Syria. Pliny the Younger, well, he just thought the world of his uncle, Pliny the Elder, who, and even when the Younger was a child, Pliny the Elder was quite famous around the Roman Empire. Pliny's father died at an early age, so of course he probably lived with his mother, and the uncle became more of a guardian and preceptor in charge of, but that was one of his guardians was Lucius Virginius Rufus, and he's quite well known for quelling a revolt against Nero in 68 AD. So Pliny was homeschooled as a result, Pliny the Younger changed his name from Gaius Cilicius Silus to Gaius Plinius Caecilius Secundus. Put that on your ball cap. So Pliny the Younger confirms that he was a trustee of his ancestors, and that's. The interest, why am I talking about Pliny, Younger, Elderly here? You've heard this, home is where the heart is, Pliny the Elder. There you go. It is generally much more shameful to lose a good reputation than never have acquired it. The only certainty is that nothing is certain. These are things we've heard around us. From the end spring new beginnings. Grief has limits, whereas apprehension has none. So we grieve only for what we know has happened, but we fear all that possibly may happen. You see people that seem timid and afraid. There's no reality to it. It's not fear, it's apprehension. Huh? Truth comes out in wine. Because people start to say things that they really mean. Truth comes out in wine. There is always something new out of Africa, he said. And the best plan is to profit by the folly of others. Hear, hear, eh? The lust of avarice has so totally seized upon mankind that their wealth seems rather to possess them than they possess their wealth. These are the nouveau riche that are still running around. I can't imagine. Old money doesn't have to show it. If you're wondering what I'm getting at here, what we're talking about with the notion of avarice and being seized by your wealth, new money demonstrates the insecurity. Not really sure how to do it. So if you have the money, you must spend it. So you spend that on, well, believe it or not, cars, houses, real estate, eh? Real estate and cars. And that's your statement of wealth. Amazing. In these matters, the only certainty is that there is that nothing is certain. So an object in possession seldom retains the same charm that it had in pursuit. I think that's a beautiful way of capturing the idea. An object in possession seldom retains the same charm that it had in pursuit. Now, do you need a little bit as we move west? A little bit of music from where? From up the Ottawa Valley. Here's a little bit of a taste of country in Ottawa Valley as we head on our west journey. Yeah, that's a woman by the name of April Virch, fiddling and dancing. That performance was in Nashville back in the 30th of September 2010. But it gives you that flavor of Ottawa Valley fiddle music. We have such a huge country. It's like we have distinct landscape, but the people have been affected by that landscape, and we're the same, but we're different all over Canada. Little piece, do you mind a little piece on? We get back and get into something a little bit Masonic. You okay with that? I'm talk to you a little bit about Ireland. You don't mind? Well, no hidden secrets in this. A little bit about Ireland, 1737. Can you go back that far with me? You switch from traveling across Canada to that. Well, the Grand Lodge 1737 in Ireland was the first Grand Lodge to issue these traveling warrants. Yeah, no, that's true. Now, England followed several years later. In the interval, the number of regiments that had applied for and received these Irish authorizations had reached a comparatively formidable figure, and that they were not permitted to lie idle is manifest in existing records, indicating that the activities of those soldier masons were not confined to redcoats, but with the principles and teachings of the ancient craft were disseminated through their missionary efforts among the best of the settlers of those primitive days. Must have been, you know, a different time. That notion of avarice and hubris, a different time. It stands in stark, our history stands, that we've captured, stands in stark contrast to the reality of a lot of lodges and lodge functions to this day. I worry, and I notice, and I think I'm not alone in this, that we could quickly become a personality cult. Where strong, dominant personalities start to define the function and the essence of Freemasonry. How in the world did that ever happen? Now, that's not going to stop the course of Masonic philosophical development. It's a temporary little glitch in the calendar, a little bit of a warp in the time-space continuum of Freemasonry. We know that there were significant and strong figures, very bright people, that are known to us through the ages, and they're passed down as beacons or living icons of Freemasonry. Authors and men of industry. It's the foundation, I think, of a lot of the growliness about our order today, that we seem to have lost the luster. Well, I think is it a reasonable discussion to think that Freemasonry was never intended to support the lions of society and business? That it is, in fact, when I listen to if you see a man living within, then you fill in the rest yourself. It's not something I want to display over the airwaves. It's private. But remember, that fellow, you capture that in your mind as the essence. Now, is it or is it not? And then how does that fit with these great, I'm not taking away the deeds, and I'm not taking away the effort, and I'm not saying that it's wrong. I'm simply saying it's easy to be swept up. We live in an era of celebrity, and it didn't just start out of nowhere. This has been growing for some time. So have we been influenced by our times into a way of defining Freemasonry that narrowed the scope of practice? I when we lie, put down the papers and notions of Freemasonry in front of us at our very large table, none of it seems to, it suggests that we do our best, but it's almost surreal. We do our best without bragging, without, you know, he who is placed in the lowest spoke of fortune's wheel deserves, you know, warrants, you know, our respect, yeah? So it doesn't say that we shouldn't achieve and be the best, be the top of the field. But it means that when we're thinking about the craft, I'm thinking, I consider that we take that modest fellow in the background who's interpreted all of this as an act of humility. You walk uprightly, but with humility before the divine being. If you take that in some sense literally, then you could be a great person, but not be at the front of the stage. You can be at the front of the stage and not necessarily be the great person. So, you know, how to sort that out, that's an individual matter, how to sort that out. So where do you stand in that type of thing? The back in the early 18th century, the Irish Grand Lodge was helping to bring about the active dispersal of Masonry in the frontiers. In 1756 to 58, the Grand Lodge of Boston authorized warrants from lodges in the expeditions against Crown Point and other places in Canada, while Scotland, about the same period, appointed Colonel Young of the 60th Regiment provincial Grand Master over the lodges in America, holding warrants for that country. After the siege and capitulation of Quebec in 1759, seven lodges holding field warrants met and celebrated the St. John's Day Festival in December, after which the masters and wardens discussed the formation of a provincial Grand Lodge, which was agreed to. They elected Lieutenant Gwinnett of the 47th Regiment as the provincial Grand Master, and the following year succeeded him with Colonel Simon Fraser of the Fraser Highlanders, afterwards the 78th Regiment, who held the office for a brief 6 months. Colonel Fraser, it is related, a statement since doubted, was installed by the famous Thomas Dunkerley, then a master in gunnery on HMS Vanguard, and was subsequently a noted figure in English Masonic circles. The Provincial Grand Lodge of Quebec, formed as stated by the military lodges, developed with time and in 1765 was presided over by the Honorable John Collins of the Executive Council, whose identity with the craft was more pronounced than any of his predecessors, mainly owing to the zeal displayed by him in the creation of lodges in many of the settled but distant sections of the Great Territory, and notably in the direction of the Great Lakes. Thus, the early progressive work of Masonry in Canada was under the auspices of the Provincial Grand Lodge of Quebec of military origin, which began with the memorable year of 1759, but of which there is little or nothing to show in the way of record. In the territory west of the Ottawa River, and which became Upper Canada in 1791, under the altered conditions, there were 10 lodges, one of these working under a field warrant from England in the 8th, or King's Regiment of Foot, two at Detroit, inactive, St. James, number 14, at Cataraqui, Kingston, and St. John's, number 15, Mackinac, both warranted by Quebec's Provincial Grand Lodge. St. John's Lodge of Friendship, number 2, origin unknown. New Oswegatchie, number 7, Provincial Grand Lodge of New York, origin Brockville. St. John, number 19, Niagara, warranted in 1787 by Quebec. Rowden, or the lodge between the lakes. was established by the moderns in, I know, touchy subject, number 498 at York, and a Union Lodge, Cornwall. Supposedly, the origin was Quebec. With the political partition of what once had been Quebec, and which by Act of Parliament became the provinces of Lower and Upper Canada, the Masonic division was likewise defined. And in 1792, provincial grand masters for each were decided upon. Sir John Johnson, who in 1788 had succeeded Sir Christopher Carleton as provincial grand master under the, quote, modern regime in Quebec, was the last who held that position. The, quote, ancients, or Athol Grand Lodge, had three warrants in Quebec, but never had agitated for provincial authority until this period, when learning that His Royal Highness Prince Edward, afterwards Duke of Kent, the father of Queen Victoria, and who, after his initiation in Switzerland, had allied himself with the first Grand Lodge of England, quote, modern, was appointed to a military command in Lower Canada, appealed to him to become their provincial Grand Master. He gracefully acquiesced, and in March 1792 was so appointed and subsequently installed. There is no record of the healing of Prince Edward from modern to ancient allegiance, and it is presumed that his first submission to the latter body was made on the occasion of his installation. At about the same period, the appointment as provincial Grand Master of Upper Canada was vested in Right Worshipful Brother William Jarvis. Yes, that Jarvis, who had been sent out as provincial secretary to His Excellency Governor Simcoe. The warrant of appointment issued to Prince Edward was ample in its provisions and practically clothed its possessor with all the rights and prerogatives of a supreme power, including the issue of lodge warrants direct. On the other hand, Jarvis was restricted to the issue of dispensations subject to confirmation by the Grand Lodge at London. It is surmised that the Masonic rank and experience of the royal brother were factors in influencing the distinction and indeed the Masonic activity of Right Worshipful Brother Jarvis in the early period of his rulership was not of a nature to excite exuberant enthusiasm. The very imperfect records show that a provincial Grand Lodge was summoned to meet in Newark, or Niagara, then the seat of government, in 1795. The representatives of five lodges being present. A printed document of the year 1796 gives the list of lodges as 12. Two other lodges were in existence in the province, one at Edwardsburg and the other at Niagara, both coming to the front subsequent to the Jarvis appointment and both holding their authority from Quebec. These, it is stated, however, were of posthumous brand, as each owed its origin to the former Quebec Grand Lodge, quote, modern, but had remained inactive in the interval. That's a little piece about the early time, your early work here in Canada, the development of the lodges. Amazing, isn't it? I hope you've find that. We have to wrap up very soon here. But the history of Freemasonry in Canada is curious, especially because it wraps around a very, very interesting piece of history of the development of the nation itself. Quebec, Ontario, French, English, Upper Canada, Lower Canada, and these upstart Americans. So there's, for anybody to say that this is tedious, I find maybe they haven't had the chance to be exposed to some of this material. I think it's remarkable that, and against the background of the development of ancients and moderns that was happening in out of the British context, I'm convinced that the personality or the character of Scotland, the character of Freemasonry in Scotland has been a significant influence from the beginning to this day on the way we function and practice and on Freemasonry as we know it, that the root of governance in London was just what it was, governance. But the nature of what we practice, I believe, has its heart in the egalitarianism of the Jacobites, the sense of cultural permanence of the Irish, the not only the claim but the living history of those two cultures, the facts about the context of monarchy in those nations. If you study that, I think we get a better sense of how and why Freemasonry is the way it is today. Now, we'll just head off to Kate and Anna McGarrigle. We have to talk a little bit about, to get into a little bit about the west coast of Canada. Eh? This is these are our sisters that have made brought Canada a little closer together from that far and distant land, British Columbia. Get the feeling that those folks have been too close to California when I hear their music. beautiful voices for sisters, Kate and Anna McGarrigle, of course, iconic Western music. I hope you're doing well on this Labor Day weekend, signifying the whatever we call the end of summer and the beginning of what's coming next. I do hope that you're finding that Radio Freemason is giving a boost to your thinking. If there's enough interest out there to shift take this discussion sideways, I'd really like the opportunity to start talking about alchemy and plunge into the depths of the darkness of mystery schools. Instead of looking at it like it was a Sunday church picnic, there's nothing about Freemasonry that would work in the, you know, we tend to work in the shadows for reasons. Oh, if you're getting an idea that it's scurrilous, forget that. Grow up. And if you think if anybody out there is thinking that this is some type of conspiracy, get over yourself. Living and getting through life is hard. And it's serious. It's not for idiots. So sometimes you actually want to have a serious conversation, and you don't necessarily have to agree with somebody to have a serious conversation. And it doesn't necessarily mean we're all going to have find the answers that we're looking for, popping and falling out of the woodwork. But it does give us a starting point. Freemasonry certainly has done that for us. And what better to wrap up a Labor Day in Canada? As you go out there, I would like you to continue to commit acts of Masonic kindness. It's important. Freemasonry is applied. It's like anything else. We have pure science, but the brilliance of application is what I think is fascinating. We thrive on the application of science. Freemasonry is applied philosophy. But we all have to be schooled in philosophy in order to understand what it is, how to use it. So, and it's not that we have to absorb, take the one great big bite and say that's it, that's all of the philosophical nature. It's to understand a particular stream of philosophical thought and then to apply that. Freemasonry gives that to us. The benefits of humanism that came in to replace the superstition of religion that was governing science, and really governing science and politics up to a certain point in the history, in our history. Our common history, I would say, here, if you're we're thinking about the Western world, not to exclude what was going on in the Far East, in China, and certainly in Arabic-speaking nations, where there was a predominance, as we know, the school of wisdom, the house of wisdom, was a phenomena that we hope is being replaced, has been replaced, and continues in different forms to this day. But kick back and listen to a little music, of course, from Quebec. If this is from Jacques Dupuis, traditional folk music. On a Labor Day. Thank you. What's not to like, hey?